useful having access to newspaper archives and seeing what was being said about things at the time. But yeah, the biographies, diaries, other history books, other textbooks. Yeah, there was quite a lot to read.
When people talk about great political failures of the 20th century, they often talk about Anthony Eden. Would you say that his foreign secretary, Selwyn Lloyd, who collaborated with him on, you know, what turned out to be quite a big lie, which was the policy on Suez, do you think he goes up with Eden into that sort of list of great political failures?
No, I don't, actually. I let Selwyn Lloyd a little bit off the hook because the decisions were really not his. He was not necessarily the foreign secretary that Britain needed. In fact, I say it clearly wasn't the foreign secretary Britain needed, but he was the foreign secretary his prime ministers wanted.
Right. That was Ted Morris, who's author of Managing Decline, British Foreign Secretaries of the 20th Century. How grand to end the programme discussing the history of Selwyn Lloyd. It's Daniel Finkelstein. This is The Times at One, and Fee and Jane are next.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much. It's 2 o'clock. Good afternoon. This is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
In the next 2 hours, will they, won't they? Keir Starmer has refused to rule out increasing income tax in the next week's budget. We'll assess that and his performance at PMQs. We'll catch up with the looming release of the Epstein files in the USA. Plus, why one rapper's unexpected support of the US president has taken her all the way to the UN, but she's been accused of spreading misleading information. And today's big interview is with Samantha Seacombe, who is a chartered financial planner and founder of Women's Wealth, who speaks about pensions, ISAs, and why women treat money differently.
And here's the news at 2 from Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Defence Secretary says he's got military options drawn up as a Russian spy ship loiters on the edge of UK waters. John Healey says the Yantar has been directing lasers at pilots of RAF aircraft monitoring it. It's operating just off the northern coast of Scotland. Shadow Defence Minister Mark Francois says Mr Healey needs to choose his words carefully.
Saying that if the Yantar continues south, we will act. Now, he deliberately hasn't told the Russians in advance what that will mean, but I take it to mean we will not allow that ship to carry on doing what it's just been doing.
Separately, the Defence Secretary's promised new arms factories after a group of MPs said the UK doesn't have a plan to defend itself from a military attack. Inflation has eased for the first time since March. Official figures show the rate at which prices are rising slowed to 3.6% last month after 3 months at 3.8%. It's a boost for the government ahead of the budget next week. The Prime Minister's welcomed the dip, but the Conservative Party leader Kemi Badenoch says it's little to celebrate.
Inflation has nearly doubled since they came into office. He wants a round of applause because it's come down a little bit. I will remind him that food inflation is up 4.9%. That is making life miserable for all of those people out there.
Labour peer Lord Dubs has accused the Home Secretary of using children as a weapon in her asylum reforms. Shabana Mahmood wants refugee status reviewed every 30 months, meaning children born in the UK could be removed with their parents if their home country is deemed safe. Former Home Office adviser James Starkey is expecting legal challenges.
Listening to some lawyers yesterday, some cases on it, that seems open to challenge. I would say if she's allowed to bring these reforms as she's laid out and they don't work, the obvious solution is going to be to leave the ECHR.
The Home Secretary's promised to get control of the asylum system. UK house prices rose 2.6% in the year to September, a slowdown from August. The Office for National Statistics says average prices now stand at around £272,000, with London the only region recording an annual fall. And the rental market is cooling too, with annual rent inflation easing for the 10th month in a row. A man's been charged with 7 further offences, as well as counts related to the stabbing spree on a high-speed train in Cambridgeshire earlier this month. They include the attempted murders of a boy and a man in separate incidents in Peterborough. After a trial, driving test candidates in Britain will be required to spend longer on faster roads during tests. It's to represent conditions many motorists experience after passing their test, including on rural routes. And there are warnings of a continued risk of power cuts and travel delays as snow and ice warnings are in force across Britain. Scotland and parts of Northern England are likely to be affected until tomorrow night. Those for Northern Ireland have now expired. The Met Office says there could be as much as 25 centimetres of snow in Yorkshire by the start of Friday, and that's likely to cause significant disruption. For News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Thank you very much, Laura. We've even had little flurries of snow here in the soppy south. I hope the rest of the country is suitably sympathetic. I suspect they really couldn't care less. What do you think?
I would imagine so. It didn't settle, though. That's what everybody has commented on.
It hasn't settled. Welcome to winter in the United Kingdom in 2025. Let's brace ourselves now. Lots to look forward to between now and 4 o'clock this afternoon. Tony Blair's former political secretary, he joins us imminently. He says it is time for Sir Keir Starmer to go. I wonder if maybe his mind was changed by the Prime Minister's performance at PMQs. Well, we'll ask him in a sec. Is the government fixing the NHS or not? Well, the Public Accounts Committee says waiting lists are not going down as promised. Let's talk about the rapper, Nicki Minaj. She's talking to the UN. She's addressing the UN. She's concerned about the plight of Christians in Nigeria. It's business as usual at the Trump White House, rolling out the red carpet for a Saudi crown prince, making light of a vile killing and dismissing a legitimate question about the Epstein files from a female journalist by saying, quiet, piggy, what a world. Tech News Wednesday, what will happen to NVIDIA's share price today? Have we reached peak AI? Chris Stokel-Walker will attempt to reassure us a little later on. And telly, it's Back to the Future. At Line of Duty, Dr. Foster and the Night Manager are all coming back. Scott Bryan tells all. And after 3:30 this afternoon, as the budget finally staggers into view, it is a week today, who have we got on, Fee?
It's like being on a very, very long straight road in Australia across the outback, isn't it? And there's one truck coming towards you. Yes, it is the budget. So we're going to talk to Samantha Seacombe after 3:30 today. She founded and runs a company called Women's Wealth. And her aim and ambition, and she is very good at it, is to tell women how to make the most of their money. There just is a difference in the way that women treat investment and treat risk, and that is borne out by statistics and fact, and she really wants to change female attitudes to money. So it's a must listen if you are a woman and if you know a woman. So that's all of you. It's 0333 003 2353 this afternoon, and Jane and Fee at times.radio. Shall I do the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon, sister?
Yeah, go ahead.
Number three, it's now common knowledge. Keir Starmer's on the rocks. That is Danny Finkelstein's column on the Prime Minister's woes. We will discuss that imminently. The second most read story is British woman among five tourists killed in Patagonia blizzard. Victoria Bond died while trekking in a popular national park in Chile. Two Germans and two Mexicans were also killed. And the most read piece on the Times website is Russian spy ship aims lasers at RAF pilots tracking it near UK waters. The Defence Secretary has told the Kremlin that we see you after a surveillance vessel was spotted near Scotland. Crew on the Yantar tried to blind RAF planes monitoring its presence. It really is quite some world we're in. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can do that by going to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Okay, so the Russians are coming. It's cold and it's budget day a week today. Welcome. Welcome, everybody. Huddle round your wireless and we'll keep you company until 4 o'clock. Keir Starmer has refused to rule out a so-called stealth tax ahead of next week's budget. He was challenged by the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, on whether Labour would freeze income tax thresholds at PMQs today.
He says the budget is next week, but we read all about it in the papers. Yeah. This is the first budget to unravel before it's even been delivered. Yeah. The Chancellor's cluelessness, I'm afraid, is damaging the economy now. The Prime Minister needs to end this shambles. So can he confirm today that he won't break another promise by freezing income tax thresholds?
Mr. Speaker, the budget is 1 week today and we will lay out our plans. But what we won't do, Mr. Speaker, I've said what we will do in terms of protecting the NHS and public services. What we won't do is inflict austerity on the country as they did. What we won't do is inflict a borrowing spree like Liz Truss did.
Keir Starmer sounding relatively robust, it has to be said, at PMQs today. But behind the scenes, many of his MPs are so concerned about his leadership, they are said to be plotting to replace him. The Times is reporting that 80 members of the so-called soft left Tribune group are ready to back a challenger to the Prime Minister. John McTurnan joins us now. He's a former Labour adviser and one-time political secretary to Tony Blair. I've got your article in the New Statesman here in front of me, John. Headline: Starmer needs to go. So we're pretty certain where you stand. Did you hear anything today that might make you change your mind?
Like all op-ed writers, there's always I never write the headline. Sure. I always write the content. But it is my view that the Labour Party is in a crisis, which can only be resolved by a leadership election. And look, Keir was robust at PMQs, and the point of that is he buried at the end there what the dividing line is. The real dividing line, in the budget that was briefed and the budget that was unbriefed and the budget we're going to get, is that Labour will not cut public services. We'll not cut public services. That's why we will raise taxes. We'll raise them fairly, raise them within our manifesto commitments. But we will never, like the Tories, reform promised to, we won't cut public services. That's a pretty robust line to have. And nor will we, like the Greens, have a fantastical magic money tree wealth tax. That won't work either. You've got to prosecute that argument with vigour and with verve. And the problem that the government has is it had one budget argument up until last Thursday night, and now it's got a different one. And communication is all about deciding on your strategy, executing your strategy and communicating your strategy, not doing an abrupt reverse, a U-turn, whatever you however you describe it. That's the problem. Stability, which everybody wants. All investors want stability. Householders want stability. People want stability. That's not there if you change your budget strategy at the very last moment. And I think that then means that nothing that is being prepared for can be explained. Nobody's doing any laying the ground for the next the budget next week.
Let's suppose it's next Thursday. Let's say the budget delivered by Rachel Reeves has been an unexpected success. Everyone actually likes what they hear. They understand what the Labour Party is attempting to do. They're prepared to put their faith in this Labour vision. Does everything you've just said change, or is there absolutely no hope for Starmer
until you're executed, there's always hope. Like, there is always hope. I suppose what I would say is the budget is just a staging post. The budget is a staging post to 2026. 2027, 2028, and the general election. It's very clear what the strategic positioning of the Labour leadership is, and it makes sense. It's us or Farage. The question is not how do you get to next Thursday. The question is how you get to a Thursday in 2028 or 2029 with an intact Labour project, an intact Labour party, and a communication strategy that actually illuminates all the policy successes. And the problem is not getting to next Thursday. The problem is there a story that explains everything that Labour's doing in domestic policy?
So it's the lack of a story, not necessarily the person delivering the story.
The story comes from the top. So the lack of a story that connects together welfare reform, health reform, education reform, local government reform, just to start with. The lack of an ability, so what Labour gets trapped into without rooting everything in vision, values and purpose, is in the end talking about process. Nobody elected a government to be better at process.
Who would you put in that role to deliver the vision that, well, perhaps you can tell us what the vision should be, because I'm now no longer certain what any kind of vision from Labour might be.
I think it's very straightforward what a vision for the Labour Party could and should be in domestic policy. It should be committed to reducing inequality. And next week's budget is likely to lift the two-child benefit cap, and that would be a major step towards taking kids out of poverty. There are ways to change the triple lock, and there's ways to change the winter fuel payments, which actually contribute to reducing inequality. There's ways to reform local government that reduce inequality. And what should the Social Democratic Party do? Should reduce inequality.
Okay, so who would you have there telling us all about that?
I think the party support for choice. Angela could do that. Angela Rayner could do that. West Reading could do that. Shabana could do that. Andy Burnham could do that if he came back to be an MP. The Labour Party support for choice amongst people who are good communicators, who have clear values, and have got a radical manifesto. The Labour Party's manifesto was radical when we elect mass majority, big landslide for a radical manifesto. But apparently an inability to talk about why that's a radical manifesto, okay. Soft left manifesto.
There's quite a big difference between Shabana Mahmood and Angela Rayner, isn't there? Shabana Mahmood's address to the Commons earlier in the week about immigration is a world away to some Labour voters and Labour members from the social vision of Angela Rayner, surely.
No, because if you don't deliver security, you are never allowed to deliver anything. Voters want security. They want border security. They want cyber security. They want economic security. They want environmental security. There's all kinds of dimensions to providing the security that voters want before you can then go on to what's your vision of running for services better, and then what's your vision of the transformation that the country needs. And it's a world which needs a transformational change, because we're facing transformational pressures, whether it's geopolitics, the Russians. We're in conflict with the Russians. We are in contest with China. But we don't have a reliable ally in the United States. We don't have a good enough relationship with the European Union. We have to tackle climate crisis. We also have to tackle the challenge of AI. All of those things don't allow for a political party that just talks about process, okay. Being a better process.
We'll get on to talk about PMQs in a moment, but honestly, you're not prepared to pick between Shabana Mahmood, Angela Rayner, Wes Streeting, and forgive me, I can't remember the other person you mentioned.
Andy Burnham. Any of those would be fine for me as the leader of the Labour Party, because they can communicate a vision, they can communicate values, and they can lead a country. And leadership is as much about telling a story as about anything else.
But at any point, did you have faith in Sir Keir Starmer?
Keir did an amazing job in turning the Labour Party around. No, Keir did in 4 years what it took the Labour Party before, 4 electoral cycles to recover from a defeat.
But he's no good as a Prime Minister.
Well, it's not that he's no good. The problem is not Keir himself. The problem is not Rachel herself. The problem is that something has gone wrong with the strategy that you can head for weeks and weeks and weeks preparing the ground for a particular type of increase in taxes, and then you just change your mind. That's not how to run a country. Or you go along with a cabinet who have got great communicators, you decide to have a drive-by on the greatest communicator in the cabinet the night before he's going to go on the media rounds to show off he's a great communicator.
Which showed what? Ineptitude on a scale that you can hardly believe?
It did show ineptitude. It also, the supporting argument that everybody in the Labour Party, starting with the MPs but going down to councillors and then to activists, has to sit up and shut up and take their medicine, because otherwise the markets will be angry. It's like, don't outsource political leadership to the bond markets. Political leadership is managing the markets, and Social Democrats manage markets. We do not get driven hither and thither by them.
Let's just have a quick word about Kemi Badenoch. She did spend most of PMQs trying to get an answer about tax, but her last question to the Prime Minister was perhaps a bit more philosophical.
People out there are struggling, Mr. Speaker. The budget chaos is causing real anxiety. People aren't buying houses, businesses aren't hiring, and they are cancelling investment decisions. 2 weeks ago, The Chancellor called a ridiculous press conference to blame everyone else for her having to raise income tax. Then last week, she U-turned on her own U-turn. Instead, we can see they're planning to freeze income tax thresholds, something she said last year would be a breach of their manifesto. They are making it up as they go along. Doesn't the country deserve better than government by guesswork?
Either we renew our country with Labour or we go back to austerity 2.0 with reform of the Tories. They left waiting lists at record highs. Almost a million more children in poverty, and they wrecked our public services. She comes here to talk down the country. We're turning the page. More NHS appointments, free breakfast clubs, free childcare, more homes and better public services. That's what we're fighting for, a Britain built for all.
John, do you find yourself in perhaps the uncomfortable position of thinking Kemi Badenoch was probably right there?
She clearly, well, she quoted from my article, I think. but the point is, give credit where it's due. That was a great performance, and that was a great question. And I think Kemi Badenoch's confidence has increased while for two reasons, in my view. One is that Robert Jenrick has shown he can't speak in public and can't make a joke, which actually takes you off the table as a political leader. But also, she has seen and is exploiting a weakness. I mean, your opponents will always exploit a weakness, and there is a weakness. There has to be said that there's a weakness. If you prepare the ground for one thing, including interrupting the morning bulletins with a press conference on number 10, and then decide not to do it, if you were going to leave it open to decide not to do it, you would have prepared in a different way. And there's something about the clash between tactic and strategy, and it's like you said, I'd love there to be a well-received Labour budget. I'd love there to be the government in a good place next Thursday. I'd love to see Labour's poll numbers rising. In the end, it's not good enough to get to next Thursday. It's not good enough to get through the next PMQs. In the end, this goes to what is the political project? What is the transformative political project that the Labour Party were elected to deliver, and how can they deliver that, given they do not have any opposition that can stop them in the House of Commons? You know, Lord Hailsham was right. Britain's an elective dictatorship. So if you're elected on a radical manifesto, execute a radical manifesto, execute it radically. If it was the right one, everybody would be happy.
Interesting. Thank you very much. That's John McTurnant, former political secretary to Tony Blair. You can read his article in The New Statesman.
We will make a leap in a couple of moments' time. Why Nicki Minaj has been speaking at the United Nations and what Trump has to do with it all. It's coming up to 20 minutes past two. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
The next stage of the COVID inquiry is about to be published. It's the most expensive inquiry of its kind in British history. So what will it find, and will it be worth it?
We're going to be talking about Ashes cricket with the former captain of England, the great Times writer Michael Atherton. And we're going to get the best letters of the week to the paper from Andrew Riley.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly, so must we. £50 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £50, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Oh, hang on, what about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel, and everyday transport. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business, and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Choose from thousands of products. Wickes have options to suit every budget. Plus, with great offers now on, it's the perfect time to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom. Find your nearest showroom at wickes.co.uk.
Now, in a festive first for the United Kingdom, the Sunday Times is going to publish Santa's Extra Nice list next month. You can nominate the names or names of special children in your life and see if they make it onto the list this year. Gosh, you'd be very annoyed if they didn't. Just send their name to Santa at thetimes.com/Santa. Right, it's 22 minutes past two. Now, as all of you Times Radio listeners know, that is Nicki Minaj. She's turned her hand to something much more serious recently and has been speaking at the United Nations in support of Trump's claim that Christians are being persecuted in Nigeria. It was part of a special event meant to draw attention to attacks by militant groups in the region, but experts say that large numbers of Muslim Nigerians are also being targeted. So where is the truth in all of this? Well, let's talk to Afua Hagen, journalist and broadcaster. Just explain a little bit about why Nicki Minaj is so interested in this particular thing, Afua.
I wish I knew, to be honest. It seems bizarre that Nicki Minaj, who, you know, has never really expressed any solidarity with Nigerian Christians or Muslims before, has now sort of jumped on this bandwagon and is buying into the oversimplification of what actually is a pretty complex problem. Yes, the Nigeria security situation at the moment is pretty dire, and there is violence against not just Christians and Muslims as well, and it's driven by multiple factors, multiple armed groups. It's not just about simply violence against Christians. It's about economics, and it's about bad governments across states. It's about ethnicity as well, and it's about climate change also. And so she seems to have been sucked into the oversimplification of what is a very serious humanitarian and security issue in Nigeria. You asked me why she was involved. I mean, you'd have to ask Nicki herself why she thought this was a good bandwagon to jump onto. But what I read into this is about Trump and his team trying to get what they think should be, quote unquote, allies for the black community to speak up for them. But it's simply just not that simple. Nicki's never really expressed any sort of solidarity with Nigeria before, and just because she's black does not mean that she fully understands the problem.
She is a woman of faith, isn't she? So presumably Donald Trump has lent into that. Do you think that this is very damaging for her, though? Because as you have just said, and other people have immediately commented, this is a complicated situation. There isn't just one community that is being persecuted here.
Absolutely. In terms of Nicki's image, I mean, Nicki has been practically naked on her album cover for years. She doesn't really care about her image, right? Because she has a legion of fans and she puts out music and those fans will be loyal to that. So in terms of doing this to enhance her image, it's not really about that. Yes, she is a woman of faith, but as you've both said before, to oversimplify this issue doesn't do it justice. It's not just about Christians being killed. And yes, they are being killed, but Muslims are being killed as well. And people without faith are being killed also. And what she would do better to do is actually try and understand the complex problems in Nigeria. And like, not even Nigerians understand them. So I don't know how Nicki Minaj thought that she would be the voice for Nigerian Christians. It's just bizarre.
What's also at fault here, I think, is the United Nations platform, isn't it? Because there is also an argument that were the United Nations to be truly representative of all parties in all countries, and it sells itself on that, it's actually not terrific to just platform one side.
Absolutely. And you know what would have been good? How about you get someone from, shock horror, Nigeria to speak to the UN about
what is... Well, that is a radical suggestion, after all.
I know, isn't it? I don't even know where I got such a crazy idea. But wouldn't... And there's lots of Nigerian musicians out there. There's lots of them that have a global platform, men and women. Any one of them could have been asked to speak at the United Nations about this issue. To have Nicki Minaj do it, I think is actually very lazy. Very, very lazy. And yes, she has a huge platform, but she doesn't understand the issue.
It is a very good point to make. So the Nigerian music scene is absolutely epic and vast, and you know, people are selling hundreds of millions of records and doing downloads all over the world. So has there been a little bit of a backlash from that music community as well?
Yes, there has been, and I have seen that online. You know, many people asking, hold on, so there's lots of, like you said, international musicians who are out of Nigeria that could speak about this problem, and you have Nicki Minaj, and it just seems weird. And like I said, it seems lazy as well. And there's a sort of real sense that this issue is being UN washed in some way. Okay, we had somebody to speak about it. That means that we're addressing it. Look, okay, we're doing something about it. Well, no, you're not doing something about it. And actually, adding to a problem, because you're not trying to delve into the real reasons behind the violence in Nigeria and what is causing it. And instead, it's just kind of like, we've got Nicki Minaj to talk about it. We've done our bit, on to the next thing. And it's very lazy on behalf of the UN, extremely lazy.
Do you know if Nicki Minaj and Donald Trump actually have an existing friendship in any way?
I mean, can you imagine Nicki and Donald sitting down to a Diet Coke or seven and discussing world issues? I've never known them to have any kind of affinity before. But this is the thing, so many people are sort of sucked into Trump's atmosphere and stratosphere, and she seems to absolutely be drinking the Kool-Aid. I think if I was advising Nicki Minaj, I would have definitely turned this down, because you're going to make yourself look extremely silly by talking about an issue that you don't have any clue about.
Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. Journalist and broadcaster Afua Hagen. We were discussing Nicki Minaj. I'll tell you what, I think that the Times Radio listeners would like just another burst of Nicki. Could we have that again before we go to the news? Useful, isn't it, that fly rhymes with high? Sky as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she's a massive artist, and props to her for all of her success. This just in from one of our correspondents this afternoon. Only Jane and Fee could find something wrong with someone standing up for a persecuted group because of Trump. Well done, ladies. Excelling yourselves as usual. I don't think that's the point of the story here at all. I don't think anybody is condemning the aim of standing up for a persecuted group, but it's a complicated situation in Nigeria. It is not just one denomination and congregation that is being persecuted. And, you know, the allegation against Nicki Minaj is she didn't seem to know all that much about the situation in Nigeria before taking to the platform. So we're not condemning people for standing up for other people, but we're saying maybe we are right to scrutinise why somebody is doing something.
Yeah, I think our correspondent has perhaps picked up on the fact that we're not Trumpers. We're not natural Trumpers.
What are you saying?
I don't know. Right, coming next on Times Radio, they say Wes Streeting could be our next Prime Minister, but how is the NHS really faring on his watch? That is next. It's Times Radio. It's 2:30. Here are the headlines. Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Defence Secretary says the UK knows Russia is trying to spy in British waters as the Navy tracks one of its vessels.
As I speak, a Russian spy ship, the Yantar, is on the edge of UK waters north of Scotland, having entered the UK's wider waters over the last few weeks. This is a vessel designed for gathering intelligence and mapping our undersea cables.
John Healey accuses the Yantar's crew of deeply dangerous behaviour after they pointed lasers at British pilots trying to monitor its movements. He says it's the second time the ship has deployed to British waters this year. The rate at which prices are going up in the shops fell to 3.6% in October. That's down from 3.8% the month before. A slower increase in gas and electricity prices was the biggest factor. The Home Secretary has criticised police and crime commissioners to their faces just days after it was announced their posts are being scrapped. Shabana Mahmood has been speaking at the annual joint summit they hold with senior police officers and labelled the positions as expensive failure. The mother of Harry Dunn has been presented with her MBE at Windsor Castle. Charlotte Charles got it for outstanding services to road safety after her son was killed by a US citizen who was able to leave the UK under diplomatic immunity laws. And starting next week, learner drivers in Britain will be required to spend longer on faster roads during tests. Officials say the move will better represent conditions many face after passing, including on rural routes. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
This is Times Radio.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly, so must we. Just £30 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £30, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7pm as she brings you Tomorrow's Times Today, an exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 70 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
But we're not Trumpers. We're not natural Trumpers.
What are you saying?
I think we're
a radio gold there. Yeah, I think we like to... Are we trying to pretend we're still balanced? No, we left that place years ago. Yeah. A final thought, I think, for the moment comes in from Chris Miller, who says, I'm all in favour of celebrities speaking out only on subjects they know something about. This would mean a blessedly long period of silence from most of them. Mm. And Jonathan just wants to draw our attention to an interview that Henry Bonsu did the other night. A detailed write-up, in inverted commas, on this. Basically, it is farmers of all faiths being attacked by pastoralists and terrorists who are in part driven by the loss of pasture due to desertification. I hope I've pronounced that right. Hello, John.
Hi there. Hello. So, as ever, it's going to be busy. I was really struck, you know, as a lot of us were, by that report, the Defence Committee report, which says we're nowhere near ready to deal with an attack, if an attack comes. And the thing is, it's not that this is a remarkable warning. It's how often you hear this now from generals and other experts in, you know, in global global strategy and all the rest of it. So this report is saying this at Westminster, and I'm talking to the chairman of the committee, Tan Dissey, and hear his views, as well as that of some strategic experts. Also going to be having some Labour gossip, some of the churn at Westminster about the leadership of Keir Starmer. Anna Mihailova is going to be joining me with, I think, some really particularly juicy tidbits of gossip. Going to be talking about football, the Scottish win. Didn't actually see the game, now wish that I really had. Yeah, it looks amazing.
The three of the four Scottish goals were some of the best I've ever seen.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And you can understand the absolute wildness in the crowd there. So I'm talking about joy at football, because people don't understand that kind of joy, apart from the millions and millions of people who do, who get just how real and important it is when your team does a thing even remotely like that. And when there's a layer of national pride involved, it's all magnified. So I'm going to be talking to a guy with a bar in Glasgow, just trying to tap into that. Might make us all feel a little bit better just for a moment or two. I'm going to be talking, and this may be related, I'm going to be talking about kissing. I don't know if you saw this study about
kissing.
We've been
doing it for millions of years.
We've been doing it for millions of years, not just us, other species too, apparently. Polar bears, among others. So I'm going to be talking to an academic about what's going on there. And Stephen Kinnock, the Health Minister, is going to be with me live too.
Isn't academia wonderful when you can specialise in snogging?
At any given moment, there's always a report.
Is there a link to Stephen Kinnock? Did I miss that?
Oh, he's a Health Minister.
Oh, OK, right. But it's nothing to do with kissing.
Well, no, not in our time, anyway.
No, but, okay, right.
Well, I mean, they could have a think about that, couldn't they?
Do you think this defence business is? Do you think it's a double bluff? Do you think we're trying to smoke out our opponents? We're saying, look, we're hopeless. We're not prepared. We're not prepared.
You know, it'd be nice to believe that was possible.
I want to comfort myself with that thought.
Let's do that.
Okay.
You won't last long then. Only until we come on air.
Thanks, John. John Pienaar with The Terrible Truth between 4 o'clock and seven here on Times Radio. Now, Labour's NHS reforms are being compared to the mismanagement of the HS2 railway project by a powerful group of MPs. Parliament's Public Accounts Committee says that waiting times are not going down as promised, with the government's promise to fix the NHS looking a little bit hollow. Clive Betts is the Labour MP for Sheffield South East, and he is the deputy chair of that committee, the Public Accounts Committee. We talked a little earlier, and I asked him what was going wrong.
Well, these, of course, are programmes that began some time ago, and they're over a three-year period. There was an attempt made, principally, to get down waiting times for outpatients and for those waiting for surgical and diagnostic tests. So that's not a happy experience. Our report shows that in all these aspects where attempts were made to get down waiting times, they weren't successful at all in terms of outpatients, or actually only partially successful in terms of the diagnostic tests and the surgery waiting times. Things have simply got to improve in the future, and where we're spending money, we've got to make sure it actually delivers the results that are intended.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy reading, really. By the summer of this year, nearly 200,000 people were waiting over a year for care, and that is a length of wait that was supposed to have just bitten the dust by March. That's not good, is it?
It isn't, and money was put into outpatient services, which is the service that most people use and most people are waiting for. 80% of journeys in the NHS end in outpatients. That's the final point where people are dealt with. And virtually the improvements that were meant to come were completely ineffective. There was no measurable improvement whatsoever in outpatient waiting time. That is just incredible. One of the reasons was that the clinicians involved in outpatients, and there are a lot of different specialties there, were never on board with this. They never got engaged with it. So if you don't engage with the people providing the service, it's quite likely the service won't get any better. And there's a really stark lesson to be learned from that particular aspect.
Okay, so the clinicians were not prepared to do what? Work on a Saturday or a Sunday? What was the issue?
I don't think it's down to that level of detail that we've gone into. What it is that they simply weren't on board. I think there's a very simple message across any reorganisation, any attempt to spend money to improve. You begin by talking to the people who are going to work to achieve that. If you don't get the employees on board, whether they're doctors at one level or the other level of people simply organising the waiting lists and making sure patients arrive on time and are properly looked after, if you don't get everyone on board, then things are likely to fail. Now, efforts are being made now to get the clinicians on board, and I understand they're beginning to move forward. It's true that when the diagnostic tests were looked at and improvements were attempted there, some improvement was achieved, not enough. And diagnostic test centres have been built because there was engagement there with the people involved with delivering them. That's worked better. But what wasn't forecast was the rise in demand for diagnostic tests. So there's more tests available, but more tests have been demanded. So waiting times haven't reduced in the way they should have.
Right. The comparisons with HS2, how at ease are you with that? Because it's quite a comparison, isn't it? And basically suggests that billions of taxpayers' money potentially has been wasted here.
Well, I think there's money being wasted on the outpatient services because nothing's been achieved. I think it's arguable about diagnostic test centres, for example, because they have been built. What wasn't done was to work through what was needed and to monitor how the increased number of test centres was going to lead to a reduced waiting times. There simply wasn't that overall look at what was being done and what it would achieve. And I think that's a really stark point and a lesson to be learned. The other point we've made, I think, is about the lack of joined up approach to this. The health service is still very fragmented. We've commented very clearly about the need for improved technology in the NHS, about linking different services together. The fact that there are some antiquated systems, there are legacy systems that need to be rapidly improved to deliver better services. But then you look at improved technology and then you find that doctors, GPs put improved services in their surgeries and consultants have improved services at their hospitals, all new technology. And then the different systems don't talk to each other.
Yeah, I mean,
that's just nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, that is a story as old as time, isn't it? Legacy IT in the NHS. But it is a huge issue because you need highly qualified people prepared to work in the NHS when they could earn more money elsewhere, presumably.
Well, some people can. It's not always true for doctors, of course, but there are other people.
I'm talking about IT specialists.
Absolutely, yes. That's precisely right. But I think people do often work there because they're committed to delivering an NHS, which they can be proud of. And it's not necessarily their individual fault. One thing we aren't very good at in this country is taking an overview of systems and saying, look, this is a system, we need to improve it, we need to bring it up to date, we need to involve the people who are working that area, and we need to join it up together. What we're looking at as a committee is going to Denmark next year, because Denmark has done a complete overhaul of their public sector IT services. In a comprehensive basis over a long period of time with benchmarks and targets and achieved the outcomes they wanted. Now, that is something that we ought to be doing in this country. It's right. Very hit and miss, a bit of improvement here, a bit of investment there, and without that overall look at the system. So HS2, in a way, has been developed like that, bit piecemeal, bit here and there, bit hit and miss, and hasn't been delivered properly.
Right, we do seem to be looking to Denmark for quite a lot of inspiration these days, don't we?
We are, aren't we? Yes, I think there are many things we can look at on our trip to Denmark. One of the things that isn't as well known is the way they've improved their public services with new investment.
Right, I mean, let's just have a quick chat about Wes Streeting. He is someone who is widely rumoured, very much in the headlines last week, to be on manoeuvre. He does stand up in public and he says all the right things about the NHS, and he tells us that various aspects of it are keeping him awake at night, and he's also made the claim that the NHS is on the road to recovery. But you seem to be suggesting that in fact it's not worth much, all this, because he isn't making improvements to the NHS. It's just not, it doesn't stand up.
Well, no, I mean, we have to be clear that these programmes we talked about were started well before Wes became Health Secretary. So, you know, these programmes were not set up, were not developed, were not planned while he was Health Secretary. So I think he's inheriting considerable problems and things that aren't working. The aim now is to learn the lessons from what happened previously and to make sure the same mistakes are not made again. Though we have been a bit critical in the report of proposals with regard to the integrated care boards and the reductions announced early this year. Now, at the drop of a hat, of them having to cut their budgets by 50%. And I think we've said, really, that that is not the well-thought-out, carefully planned sort of way to run a health service. Okay. It doesn't take with them the people who are going to have to deliver those plans, those changes. And I think that's a really big problem.
Yeah, you're not the only people offering constructive criticism of Wes Streeting's NHS. The Institute for Government, only a couple of days ago, described the government's approach to NHS reform as chaotic and incoherent. Now, we know that so many people in Britain put the NHS as their first priority, and it's just, quite simply, it's just going belly up on Labour's watch.
No, I don't think we've said that in the report. I don't think you'll find anywhere we've used that phrase. And we make it clear, the comments are about programmes that were in place before the election. They were developed, they were funded, and they didn't work. So we've got lessons to learn. I think that's been very clear. And I don't want to get into a party political argument here, because the Public Accounts Committee we are party politicians, but we work together across party to make constructive criticisms where things haven't been delivered in the way that was intended. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to help future governments in terms of learning those lessons. But we have been critical of the current reforms. The ICB changes are unplanned and, I would say, incoherent, and they could lead to significant damage to services at local level.
The thoughts of Clive Betts, who is a Labour MP and Deputy Chair of the Public Accounts Committee.
Coming up, three TV big boys are storming back to our screens. We're going to unpick those with the TV critic Scott Bryan. It is 12 minutes to three. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Embark on an evening expedition, rounding up the latest news and previewing tomorrow's headlines. Plus, don't miss Hit the Road, your essential weekly travel guide to the best destinations across the UK and beyond. Every Monday to Thursday night from 7 on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Designed for every adventure. Search New Volkswagen California to find out more.
Download the Free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mom was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were 2-for-1 at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world, baking. Mm. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help, it still is.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
A national book token gives a world of discovery, where imaginations run wild with endless possibility. They might choose a voyage to stars and black holes, or to relive their team's most legendary goals, to learn how to draw, to grow, to bake, or scare themselves silly and stay wide awake. From the depths of love to the depths of the ocean, give a gift beyond words, give a National Book Token. Buy now in bookshops, everywhere, and online.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So it is a big week for TV news. Line of Duty, The Night Manager and Dr. Foster all announced they're returning to our screens. Scott Bryan is our favourite TV critic and quite simply the best. Hello, Scott.
Oh, thank you for the lovely introduction. You're right.
No, I'm clearly unwell. Let's talk about these three big hitters. It tells us something, doesn't it, about the state of the TV nation at the moment, I think.
I think it does, yes, in a good and bad way. I think in a good way, I mean, there's no denying the fact that these shows are incredibly popular. Line of Duty, when it finished with Series 6 in 2021, you know, that was a show that was 17 million viewers, which was, I think, the highest, most watched drama since Modern Records began in 2002. You know, I mean, absolutely huge. Also, Dr. Foster, very popular as well. The Night Manager was a big collaboration between Amazon and the BBC. Interestingly, I found out earlier today, all originally commissioned by the same head of BBC drama back in that era in the early noughties, Ben Stevenson. So quite a legacy too. I guess to some people, there will be sort of some frustrations thinking, well, isn't there anything new, obviously? And also that classic sort of sense of, Why are we continually rebooting programmes rather than maybe just leaving them be? But I'd say that in regards to Line of Duty, I think it's a show with a very simple premise. So it is this copper bent. It's something that you can reprise as many times as you would want to, and I think people will still tune in. I think also, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether they address the issues surrounding, well, the divided opinion around the identity of H, which I wouldn't want to reveal in case you haven't found out about it. But, you know, that had a bit of split opinion, whether they'll continue that storyline or start completely afresh. And also, it's something I think that the BBC can try to compete with the likes of Netflix. I mean, the BBC with Line of Duty were able to have the whole nation talking in the same way as they were able to do with The Traitors, in the same way that they were able to do with Gavin and Stacey. So if they can try to replicate that again, I think it would be to their benefit at obviously a very difficult time for them.
I mean, it's such a comfort to viewers who've enjoyed those three series, isn't it, to know that they're coming back. I suppose what always amazes me, Scott, is that they can get the actors, because, I mean, all of the actors involved in those three dramas are incredibly in demand, and it would be terrible, wouldn't it, if maybe Vicky McClure had said, no, I don't want to be part of Line of Duty, but Adrian Dunbar and Martin Considine had said, actually, I do. And you can't have Dr. Foster without Saran Jones. So they must be on the mega bucks for these things.
They must be. I mean, also, an interesting sidebar about Saran Jones. I was once watching a BBC One comedy starring Saran Jones, turned it over to BBC Three, and Saran Jones was on another one of those shows at exactly the same time. So I think she's got certainly versatility. I mean, I would say with Line of Duty, it wouldn't have worked if you didn't have all three confirmed to be taking part in this, because I think one of its successes is that it has major characters, I think, given equal weight, and all of them a little bit flawed, all of whom also have very memorable catchphrases that you can't just swing in another character and expect it to be as successful as it was before. So, yes, I think probably a lot of relief. But then again, would you turn away from a show that has so many millions of viewers to go on to another project that might not work as well? I mean, it is quite hard to walk away from TV.
Yeah, I know, we'd all hate you for it. Let's talk about something completely different that is coming our way as well. An adaptation of Nick Cave's novel, The Death of Bunny Munro, which has been adapted for TV. What flavour of TV can you find this on?
So it will be on, well, it is out actually today on the streaming service Now and on Sky. It's set in Brighton in sort of early 2003. The opening titles are of the burning down of West Pier, which is actually, funnily enough, near where I am today. And it's a book, it's based on the book by Nick Cave that came out in 2009. It was seen to be a book that was unadaptable, just because a lot of the book is a monologue of the main character, in this case, Bunny, played by Matt Smith. And it's like a sort of a portrait of a man's life completely and utterly falling apart. He's not a very likable character in this, and you end up following him on an increasingly erratic road trip around Brighton. I think what's really interesting about it is, as I alluded to earlier, the main character is not likeable in the slightest. I think actually, quite honestly, one of the most repulsive people I've seen on TV for quite some time. But yet you become entranced by them, I think, because you're trying to work out why they are the way that they are, why they end up doing things that are so horrible, but also they go out of their way to make their life as hard as it is possible. It's also written by a person called Pete Jackson, who was behind a drama called Somewhere Boy, which was out in 2022, I think. It was on Channel 4, and it was one of my favourite dramas of that year. Pete can just really, really write, and he's taken, I think, the essence of what made the book so successful and put it onto the screen. And I think it's also, I mean, this is not a comment on Brighton or Hove, but it's got this kind of declined seaside charm about it. It's depressing, yes, but in a way that really sort of, I think, speaks to the time of year, and it's got a distinctive style. So I'd say if you've you don't have to be a fan of Nick Cave either to enjoy it. Nick Cave does the music throughout it, but it's not just for Nick Cave fans.
I don't think anybody in Brighton and Hove would be upset by you saying that, Scott, would they? Isn't part of the attraction that it's just a tiny bit grubby under the pier?
Well, I can ask my mate Charlie sat next to me, because he's actually a local resident and I'm staying with him. So he's got more of an opinion about this than probably okay. I would be,
is,
really.
Is Charlie upset?
Charlie, you upset?
No, it's all very true.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Charlie.
We're happy with it.
Thank you. Just a tiny word, if you can, Scott. I'm a Celebrity is back on our screens, isn't it, with, I don't know, not very much enthusiasm. Do you think that this has actually, this is the last ring out of the tea bag we can have in the jungle?
Well, it's still doing quite well for ITV. I mean, it's some of the most popular shows for them all year, but has been a noticeable decline kind of night in, night out. I think one of the most noticeable things is that there isn't a controversial politician, which of course created a lot of headlines, but you know, the omission this time around, I think, has maybe made it less kind of polarizing, therefore driving less people to it.
And so, do you know if they asked people and simply couldn't get anybody?
I don't know in this case, but I think that Kevin Lyga, who's the head of ITV, did actively say, from what I can recall, about a year ago, that they weren't going to have politicians on. Actually, correct me, not Kevin Lyga, Anton Deck, who of course are the presenters of I'm a Celebrity.
Okay, and that would have been after Farage's appearance?
After Farage, yeah. Yes. Some comments they said on their kind of after show they have on ITV.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed for that, Scott. All the best to Charlie as well. Very nice to meet you too. Enjoy your time down on the South Coast. Are you intrigued by I'm a Celebrity this time around?
I haven't watched a moment of it.
No.
I don't even know who's in it.
It's really, really, really not grabbed me. And maybe it's exactly that point, because it hasn't got somebody political in it. That might have been the draw for me.
I did read in one of the tabloids that Angela Rayner had been offered big bucks, but turned it down. She probably would have been a draw for me, if I'm honest.
I would have watched if Ange had been in the jungle. Yeah.
Indeed. Just want to mention Sam, who says, during the interview about the NHS, Jane made repeated attempts to put the blame for inherited failures on the current government. Anti-government bias from Times Radio, says Sam in Brecon. Sam, yes, apologies if that was where you interpreted it. I think it is widely understood that many of the NHS's current travails are indeed the responsibility of the previous Tory administration. But has Wes Streeting perhaps exaggerated the progress he has made? Anyway, thoughts? You can let us know what your experiences is. 0333 003 2353.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, 3 o'clock now. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio. In the next hour, we'll go to Washington, where Donald Trump has given the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia a rather controversial and very lavish, very warm welcome. We'll find out in our tech news why one man is suing Google over AI misinformation. And after 3:30, ahead of the budget, are you a woman? Do you have money? You need to listen to our guest, the founder of Women's Wealth, Samantha Seacombe. And if you're a man, you should also listen, by the way. Let's get the news at 3 o'clock. Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Labour's NHS reforms are being compared to the mismanagement of the HS2 railway project. Parliament's Public Accounts Committee says waiting times aren't going down as promised, with the government promised to fix the NHS looking hollow. Clive Betts is the Labour MP for Sheffield South East and the deputy chair of the committee, and told Jane and Fee the situation must get better.
In all these aspects where attempts were made to get down waiting times, they weren't successful at all in the terms of outpatients, or actually only partially successful in terms of the diagnostic tests and the surgery waiting times. Things have simply got to improve in the future. Where we're spending money, we've got to make sure it actually delivers the results that are intended.
The Defence Secretary says a Russian spy ship is on the edge of British waters trying to get information about undersea cables.
This is the second time this year that this ship, the Yantar, has deployed to UK waters. So my message to Russia and to Putin is this. We see you. We know what you're doing. And if the Yantar travels south this week, we are ready.
John Healey accuses the ship of deeply dangerous behaviour because it pointed lasers at RAF planes which were tracking it. This morning, the Defence Select Committee of MPs are warning the UK doesn't have a plan to defend against invasion. Ministers say they recognise there is a new era of threat. A judge has blamed the lack of funding of the court system as he refused to keep an attempted murder suspect on remand. Despite significant risk of reoffending, the man accused of trying to kill someone in an attack in East London earlier this year is being freed from prison. Judge Silas Reid's ruling has been described as a disaster waiting to happen. The backlog of Crown Court cases is currently more than 78,000, with trial dates being set as far away as December 2029. Inflation has eased, with official figures showing the rate slowed from 3.8% to 3.6% last month, but there's been another jump in the pace of food price rises. In the House of Commons, the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch accused the Prime Minister of wanting a round of applause, despite inflation being higher now than at the general election. Sir Keir Starmer insists the situation has been much worse.
She talked about inflation, it went to 11% or more. 11%, and the country is still paying the price. Inflation is down this morning, wages are up, and we've had five interest rate cuts, and that's because our fiscal rules are ironclad.
Starting next week, learner drivers in Britain will be required to spend longer on faster roads during tests. Officials say the move will better represent conditions many face after passing, including on rural routes. In 4 years to 2023, nearly half of crashes for 17 to 24-year-olds were where someone was killed or seriously injured happened in the countryside. And the Severn Trent CEO will step down after 11 years in charge. Liz Garfield will leave her job at the end of December after a rise in profits for the first half year of the company, which supplies 4.7 million households and businesses in the Midlands and Wales. And for News Bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's coming up to 4 minutes past three. You're listening to Jane and Fee here on Times Radio. We're going to talk about women investing after 3:30, but a relevant conversation if you're a man and you'd like to pick up some investing tips too. We're going to do that with Sam Seacombe. She is the co-founder of a company called Women's Wealth. And this is on all of us, isn't it? Especially if the Chancellor changes tack and tries to persuade us to put more money into stocks and shares, particularly into UK markets, rather than head for the safety of cash ISAs. All of that to come. We're going to start, though, by looking across to America. The senators unanimously agreed to pass legislation forcing the Justice Department to release its files related to Jeffrey Epstein. It's been sent to the desk of President Trump, who after months of trying to kill the bill now says the Republicans have got nothing to hide. And Trump has been busy rolling out the red carpet for Saudi Arabia's leader, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, whose extraordinary admission that the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi was a mistake was smoothed over even further by Trump, who described Khashoggi as someone who a lot of people didn't like and told the press pack off. You don't have to embarrass our guest by asking a question like that, he said. Well, let's talk to a man in the room, Jeff Mason, White House correspondent for Reuters. A very good afternoon from us in London, Jeff. Let's start with the release of these files.
How soon could that happen? And why does there have to be legislation in place for these files to see the light of day?
Well, the answer to your second question is there doesn't have to be legislation in place. In fact, the president could direct the Department of Justice to release those files right now if he wanted to. And that is just something that he hasn't wanted to do. And as you rightly said in your introduction, the president broadly has been opposed to getting this information out in the first place until he realized in the last several days that the Congress was going to go on and do this without him. So he ended up changing his position and encouraging Republicans in the House to vote for the release of the files. And that was one thing that led to the massively large vote in favor of doing so in the House this week.
Trump said that he was going to release the files as part of his election campaign. We have seen him flip-flop on that. And now, today, he's saying, yes, absolutely, go for it. But does that mean that there might still be time for him to change his mind again?
I mean, he could theoretically decide to veto this legislation, but that's not what he says he's going to do. I think the sort of a similar question or a similar outcome to this will be, even with his signature on the legislation, how does the Department of Justice, which has these files, respond? Do they take a long time to do it? Do they take a long time to go through and redact information? What sort of criteria do they use for the redactions? What do they decide is classified or not classified? So there are still many questions that are up in the air about what happens, even with this legislation now passed and likely to be signed by President Trump once it hits his desk.
What do you think we're going to find out?
You know what? I'm a journalist. It's not my job to speculate. But I do think that as somebody who's been covering this story, that there's so much speculation about it. Regardless of what is in there, there's going to be a really, really high level of interest. And I also think it's important to note that one of the reasons that speculation is high is because President Trump, as a presidential candidate, and the people around him before coming into office really hyped up the Epstein files and created the impression, among his supporters that there was something there to hide and that they were going to be the ones to release it. So that's at least one reason why his own supporters have largely driven this train. They expected these files to be released. Then the Trump administration did not release them. Clearly, Democrats also were on that train and saw a political vulnerability for the president and wanted to exploit it. But it was also very much the disappointment by his own supporters and by his base that led to this moment occurring right now.
We talk so much about the political effect of the Epstein files at the moment, don't we, Jeff? And actually, there was a huge gathering of women, many of whom who were the girls on the plains, on the island, in the mansions. They want to see more prosecutions. They want to see justice. Do you think that that comes closer because of what's about to be released? Or let's be honest about this, if more damaging revelations are released about incredibly powerful, very rich men, is it just more anguish for them?
These are all good questions, and many of them are questions that I just simply can't answer. But what I can say is the Department of Justice earlier this year, based on what it had in the files, said that there was nothing more that it needed or could prosecute. That has changed a little bit in the last few weeks because President Trump directed the Department of Justice to investigate ties between Jeffrey Epstein and prominent Democrats, which is pretty in line with his broad desire to go after political or perceived political foes. But I say all of that now in part to just prepare people for the possibility that once these files come out, there may be things in there that are very interesting or damning, but it is a cadre or a pile of material that lawyers have already looked through and determined that no more prosecutions were warranted.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for all of that. Let's turn our attention to other things that have been happening in and around the White House. President Trump has been hosting MBS, the ruler of Saudi Arabia. It was an extraordinary press conference, Jeff, wasn't it, in terms of its chumminess, its sucky-uppiness, the discussion openly of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. What did you make of it all?
That discussion of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi happened because reporters asked about it, which of course is what reporters needed to do in that situation. It was very, I think, present in the room, the fact that this is someone, the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, who only a few years ago was largely considered an international pariah because of that murder, and because of what U.S. intelligence said about the murder, which was that he was aware of it and likely approved it. So there was a huge kind of turnaround in his position internationally to be invited to the sanctum of the Oval Office, and the body language between President Trump and the man many people call MBS was very positive and chummy, as you said, and reflected how important certainly this president sees the relationship with Saudi Arabia, enough to dismiss even the U.S. intelligence version of what happened to Mr. Khashoggi several years ago.
MBS also said he felt bad about the pain that families affected by 9/11 had felt. And I wonder, Jeff, how that goes down in America all these years later.
Well, 9/11 families are still a very powerful political force in the United States, and they've been pressuring multiple administrations, Democratic and Republican, to do more about Saudi Arabia and its role. And, I think the fact that he acknowledged that is something that reflects that he's aware of the politics in the United States. He's very aware of that and of, I think, multiple things with regard to politics in the United States. He's clearly a good student of U.S. politics. But I think it's also a reflection, again, to your initial question, of the fact that this is still very raw for American families who were touched by 9/11.
Yeah. Can we just talk a tiny bit about the relationship between the press and Trump at the moment as well, Jeff? Donald Trump tried to belittle the reporter from ABC who asked that specific question about Jamal Khashoggi, calling her one of the worst in the business, dismissing ABC as fake news. And it isn't the only time that Trump has cut down a female journalist this week. Let's listen to this.
Jeffrey Epstein and I had a very bad relationship for many years. But he also saw a strike because I was president. So he dictated a couple of memos to himself. Give me a break. You're going to find out, what did he know with respect to Bill Clinton, with respect to the head of Harvard, with respect to all of those people that he knew, including J.P. Morgan Chase.
Sir,
yeah, Jennifer, go ahead. Go ahead.
Quiet, Piggy.
Well, that is Donald Trump at the end saying, quiet, Piggy, to a female journalist who is asking a subsequent question. Jeff, what does the press pack make of all of this, these barbed arrows and put-downs that are aimed directly at you?
Oh, I'm going to be nuanced in how I answer that question. There was a time when I was the president of the White House Correspondents Association during President Trump's first term where I had the job of speaking for the press corps, but I don't wear that hat anymore, and so I can't speak for the rest of my colleagues. What I can say is both of the reporters that you are referencing are terrific, and both of them were asking very important questions, questions that related to the news of the day and that related to their jobs as White House correspondents. And I certainly support that. I've been in situations where he has gone after me for the questions that I ask. And it is something that is kind of part of the job now of covering the White House, is to be prepared for that. But it is our job to ask tough questions. And that's what we'll continue to do.
Sure. I just find the actual phrase quiet piggy just so offensive, Jeff. I mean, I don't think he would have said that to you as a male reporter. So, I mean, it's really horrible, isn't it?
I understand the question. I'm not going to be drawn into sharing an opinion other than to say that the reporters who ask those questions are terrific and they ask questions that needed to be asked.
Yeah. for sure. Good to talk to you, Jeff. Thank you very much indeed. Jeff Mason is White House correspondent for Reuters. And it's a difficult place to be at the moment, Jane, isn't it? Because also, I think, as we heard there from Jeff, it's maybe become difficult as a member of the press to talk about the way that other members of the press are being treated.
Because he really felt uncomfortable.
You don't want it to come back on you. Yeah. And things were, you know, will come back on individual reporters under that administration at the moment. That is what we see happening all the time.
We've just heard it. We've just heard a man just, perhaps I'm going to say, frightened.
Not want to get involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is the world we currently live in.
It is. How would you feel if someone, in response to a question, a valid question that you were asking, that would have been asked by anybody on that plane, if someone turned around to you and said, quiet piggy?
Well, I mean, we've both interviewed celebrities, authors, politicians of all stripes over many hundreds of years now. And no one has ever, I'm sure, and certainly never spoken to me like that. It is unthinkable in Britain that, particularly that a politician, and heaven forfend that an elected prime minister, for example, of this country.
Imagine if Keir Starmer
turned
round to Beth Rigby and said, quiet piggy. Or to anybody on,
it
on,
is
on a plane.
Simply, America has set itself a new low standard, and I just feel just very sad about it all. I really, really do. Yeah, couldn't happen here, wouldn't happen here.
No, and we're lucky to be this side of the pond.
We really are.
Should make the most of the fact that we still can ask questions very openly and expect an answer that doesn't automatically cut us off at the knees because that person just simply doesn't want to answer.
Yeah. We will be upsetting people who think we're anti-Trump. Well spotted, by the way. We don't like Donald Trump. I think that's all right. It's an entirely legitimate position, and I've always felt that 20 years from now, We'll have the last laugh.
Well, we've been talking about it, haven't we? About how we all maybe should have responded 10 years ago to the first appearance of the reality TV star, a massive business success story that was Donald Trump. So, I don't think we're changing sides anytime soon.
It's not going to happen. 18 minutes past three. What's next? Well, something even more cheery. When will the AI bubble burst? Yes, it's our weekly check-in with tech guru Chris Stoker-Walker. Let's hope he can reassure us this Wednesday. We're not sure, obviously, that he will be able to. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Those who are curious feel an urge to travel, to explore the world. At Viking, we create voyages for the thinking person because travel enriches the mind and connects cultures in meaningful ways. With small, modern, all-veranda ocean ships that were designed to bring you closer to the destination, discover the world's iconic cities and quaint villages. Exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
No one sees your small business like you do. The feeling when that unexpected big contract comes in. The butterflies. But that's the exciting bit of it being your business. And you wouldn't have it any other way. So breathe it all in. When your business is your life, we exist to help you live. Search O2 Business.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Choose from thousands of products. Wix have options to suit every budget. Plus, with great offers now on, it's the perfect time to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom. Find your nearest showroom at wix.co.uk.
Everything's computer.
We're not Trumpers. We're not. It's Tech News Wednesday. Chris Stokel-Walker is about to join us. The stock market is holding its breath ahead of the AI chipmaker Nvidia reporting its quarterly earnings later on today. The market is in the middle of a four-day sell-off. Tech companies are taking the brunt of it. So, Chris, what time does this news from the chipmaker Nvidia actually drop? It's late this evening, our time, I think.
It is 10 o'clock UK time. We will learn whether or not we are finally going to see the bubble burst. Obviously, we've been talking about this week after week. We've made it through another week and we haven't had this huge bubble exploding yet. Whether or not we make it to next Wednesday, I might be crying into my cornflakes or something like that as I prepare what we're going to talk about in this week's session. I'm not quite sure yet, Jane.
OK, you better just explain the significance of this company, what it produces, because I know people are trying to, they're doing their best to keep up with this saga, but who are they? Why are they so significant? Why could they have such an impact, frankly, on just about everybody listening?
Yeah, Jensen Huang is the CEO of NVIDIA. He is an interesting character, a Taiwanese citizen, emigrated into the United States, set up this company, which was initially designed to develop computer chips. Those computer chips were never meant to be used necessarily for AI. They were originally used to improve the performance of video games on computers, to actually render the graphics that you see in kind of cartoonish games much better on what were, in the 1990s when he came up with this idea, pretty staid and slow PCs. Obviously, what we saw then was when we get to the 2000s and the 2010s and the 2020s, people realizing that they could use these same computer chips that were very good at rendering graphics to do the calculations simultaneously that are required to power AI systems. So suddenly, NVIDIA skyrocketed in value. And truthfully, that's only happened in the last 3 to 5 years as the AI revolution has really taken place. Now, the reason why we're talking about NVIDIA more than any other company and why it continually comes up in our conversations is because of its outsized impact. So this is a $5 trillion company, or at least was until the market sell-off relatively recently. It is very much dominant, not just in the AI space now, Jane, but also in terms of the broader economy. Something like one in every $12 that is traded on the S&P 500, the 500 leading shares in the United States, is traded in NVIDIA. And so, therefore, wherever NVIDIA goes, basically, the stock market writ large will also go with it. And that is why this is such a hotly anticipated moment.
OK, and there has already been reaction here, the FTSE 100. What's happened?
Gone down a little bit, but also kind of insulated potentially from this in the future. The reality is that nobody actually knows. So we've seen traders making their bets on what is going to happen in now, what, a 7.5 hours time or so. There is, and this is what I love about the stock markets, is the reality is you just kind of stick your finger up in the air and decide which way the wind is blowing. There is an agreement that there will be a 7% move. There is not an agreement on whether that will be a 7% move positively or negatively. Now, unfortunately, that means that we'll probably just find out tomorrow morning when we wake up. I wouldn't recommend staying up, although I will be, because I am that dedicated.
Well, it's your job. I'm just looking at a newspaper headline. This is The Sun. Google boss in AI crash fear. I mean, these stories do keep coming. You're basically suggesting that we all just sit tight and hope for the best. Is that honestly all we can do?
I think so, unfortunately. I mean, it is worth pointing out, yes, Sundar Pichai, who is the CEO of Google, he had a very interesting interview that was syndicated across multiple media earlier this week, saying that he worried that if the AI bubble bursts, that it will take down an awful lot of companies with it. In part, the reason for that is this overexposure within the traded markets to AI companies and big tech more generally. So we have a group of companies called the Magnificent Seven. Amongst them, there are companies like NVIDIA, like Apple, like Amazon, like Google, or Alphabet, its parent company. And collectively, they are worth now around about a third of all of the US traded stocks that we are available to get access to. So that is a record high in terms of such a large exposure to such a small number of individual companies. And if you look at sort of the growth of the US stock market in the last 6 months or so, more than half of that has come solely from those seven companies. And, you know, as we've been talking about over the last several years, those companies are going all in on AI, believing that this is really the future. And obviously then, if this doesn't come out in the way that they expect and it doesn't pan out, we've seen Sundar Pichai talking about it. Also, Sam Altman, CEO of OpenAI, has been talking about he believes there will be a bubble at some point bursting, then that does have its impact. But one thing that is slightly different is that we do still have people using this. So we have nearly a billion people use AI systems every single week worldwide. That won't go away if there is a bubble. So that is why I've been saying over the last several weeks, we do need to bear in mind that actually, yes, you know, this is likely to right-size itself at some point, but actually probably not as catastrophic as those of us with longer memories, the 2000.com bubble.
OK, I think there's some reassurance somewhere in there.
Yeah,
right. Now, I guess this is really about the authorities in the States, in this case the US Federal Trade Commission, trying to rein in big tech. This is Meta, who have won an antitrust case against the US Federal Trade Commission. Why have they won it? What was this about?
This was effectively about Meta's purchase of two large companies that you probably didn't realise were actually not originally Meta products. So WhatsApp, the messaging service that many of us use, as well as Instagram, both of those were actually acqui-hires in terms of Meta buying these in from other companies and then rolling them into their products. There was a case made by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, the antitrust body within the United States, saying that actually this was not okay for Meta to do because it gave them too much concentration within those individual markets. Meta has around about 4 billion users across what the company calls its Meta family of products, which, you know, makes me a little bit sick in the mouth to try and actually describe it in that way, but by the by, basically. But they were saying that this is too dominant a share in terms of having control over lots of different aspects of our digital lives. Turns out that when this was tested in court, Meta managed to make a defence that actually there is some competition, that this did not necessarily tamp down the ability for competitors to rise up and go against it, citing, you know, the rise of other companies like TikTok and others, and saying, well, actually, we're not dominant in some areas. Instagram is not necessarily the big one in terms of video sharing, or YouTube is competing with us as well. Mm. And it turns out that that court case agreed with them, so they do not have to break up, which is a very much a big bullet dodged for Meta.
Okay, so will the authorities, in this case, again, I keep saying the Federal Trade Commission, will they try again briefly?
I believe so. Possibly they will try and do so. They're reviewing all of their options. They said that they were deeply disappointed in the decision and they do want to try and rein in big tech.
Okay. Well, good luck with that. Let's talk about this. This is an interesting story. If you watch this series, I did, on Apple, it's called Blackbird, and it was about a convicted drug dealer who worked with the FBI as an informant in a psychiatric jail. And his life was the inspiration for this show, Blackbird. But he's suing Google for telling a different version of events. Now, what's happened here?
Effectively, whenever you Googled his name, and his name was James Keane, you were presented with an alternative reality that was created by AI. So Keane himself, you know, is freely admitting that he is no angel. You know, he is a convicted drug dealer. He confesses to the fact that that was the case. He did agree to work with the FBI in order for some clemency from law enforcement, and did a pretty good job while in prison, as you say, in terms of seeing that Apple TV series. But basically, he was linked with crimes through AI overviews when you searched his name that he did not commit. So rather than being a drug dealer, he became a murderer because, frankly, AI doesn't necessarily know the difference between day or night. It doesn't inherently know anything, and it was creating what we would call in the media defamatory lies, effectively. And that was something that they thought was very, very dangerous.
Right, presumably it could do the same for any one of us. You could suddenly find yourself in an AI version of your life that you are indeed a serial killer.
Yeah, it can and has done. So this is one of about half a dozen cases that have already been brought in the United States against various AI companies, believing that individuals have been defamed. This is a big problem within AI, and it's a bigger problem because actually AI is being put front and centre in a field of technology that we previously have thought of as pretty impregnable to lies, which is search results. Generally, when you put something into a search engine, the results that you get, you tend to trust because you can interrogate where they've come from, what the facts are in a situation. Now that we're seeing these AI summaries, you don't necessarily know where they've come from, but they are given the veneer of legitimacy. And that is, I think, a big problem. Google, for its part, says it has recognised this, tried to solve it, although, you know, that is a big issue.
But Chris, where does the AI overview get its defamatory information from?
So what it does, Fee, is it basically tries to do what we do, which is it looks through various links, it clicks through them, understands the context on the page. But unlike us, because it doesn't have a brain, it doesn't have the ability to try and connect and interrogate that information, it will draw parallels and connections based on what it sees on the page that are not correct. So, I mean, we're not certain in this case, and I have to be very clear, I'm not certain how this exactly happened in this specific instance. But what can happen is, for instance, you can have a name of an individual who is completely innocent, maybe a victim perhaps of a crime, placed on a web page against the perpetrator of that crime and the details of that crime. And instead of linking the perpetrator, it can link the victim to the crime because it doesn't inherently know the difference between a perpetrator and a victim. It just sees that those two words, the name and the individual, and the actual claim of what they're doing, are close together in terms of that text. So it can't actually think about what is going on here. It doesn't inherently know anything.
Wow, that has the potential to cause so much upset, and that's putting it mildly. Chris Stoker-Walker, thank you very much indeed. Chris will be back with us, alarming us again very soon with the best tech news in the business.
I'm going to put up a picture of Jane Garvey and a blancmange and see where we get to in 10 years' time.
I dread to think.
We'll hear from Samantha Seacombe after the latest news headline all about women's wealth. Let's get those headlines first with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. MPs have likened the government's NHS reforms in England to mismanagement of HS2. Parliament's Public Accounts Committee says waiting times aren't going down as promised, with the government pledge to fix the NHS looking hollow. By the summer of this year, nearly 200,000 people were waiting over a year for care, despite promises waiting times would reduce by March. Clive Betts is a Labour MP for Sheffield South East and the deputy chair of the committee, and explained a possible reason for it.
Money was put into outpatient services, which is the service that most people use and most people are waiting for. 80% of journeys in the NHS end in outpatients. And virtually the improvements that were meant to come, completely ineffective. No measurable improvement whatsoever in outpatient waiting time. That is just incredible. One of the reasons was that the clinicians involved in outpatients were never on board with this. They never got engaged with it.
Former Metropolitan Police Officer David Carrick has been found guilty of more sexual offences, including against a 12-year-old girl in the late 1980s and raping a former partner. The 50-year-old's already serving a life sentence after admitting other sex attacks against 12 women over 17 years. Inflation has eased for the first time since March, giving a boost to the government ahead of the budget next week. Official figures show it slowed to 3.6% last month after 3 months at 3.8%. A Russian spy ship is currently on the edge of UK waters, gathering intelligence and mapping our undersea cables. The Defence Secretary John Healey has warned the Russian president, "We know what you're doing." And we're still being warned there's a risk of power cuts and travel delays with snow and ice warnings in force in Britain. Scotland and parts of northern England are likely to be affected until tomorrow. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
This is Times Radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar, and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone, and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programmes and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate. To finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 70 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the spend and save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
Now, the budget is a week away. Unless you're Rip Van Winkle or you've been on an extended digital detox, you will know that it might be a big one for all of our financial futures. One of the changes that has been run up the flagpole is that Rachel Rees might change the tax-free allowance for ISAs trying to send us into stocks and shares investments. And she'll need all hands on deck if that change is made. Some people might need more convincing than others. The fingerprints left on all aspects of money are very different between the sexes. Samantha Seacombe is the founder of Women's Wealth, and we started this chat by asking her if it's true that women are really far less likely to invest their money in the markets.
Yes, there is. Some of it related to what we earn, some of it related to how we feel about investing. But yeah, the gap is huge. And I wish I could say it was closing at a significant rate, but it's not. Not.
Why is it not closing if those factors are changing?
What factors are changing, though? Because, you know, it's been illegal to pay women differently since 1970, and yet there is still a gender pay gap. And all the time women don't earn the same as men, their pensions won't be the same size as men's. Neither will they have as much in the way of disposable income to dedicate to investing. So any investing that happens for the family is likely to be in the higher earner's name. We have a tax system that promotes that inequality.
How? How does it promote it?
If you want to, if you're talking to a man and a lady and the man's earning more than, well, whoever's earning the most, the optimum tax outcome that we address as financial planners is the high earner who's paying the highest rate of tax gets the most tax relief if the investments are done in their name.
Oh, I see.
Which is fine if you're planning for tax optimization, but rarely actually when you sit down in front of two people who are earning significantly different amounts of money to each other, does anyone actually say, are you happy as the lower earner to be disenfranchised in all future investment decisions and to end up with only a fraction of the assets that you as a family are generating between you in your name and under your control?
Because we don't know for certain that the, at that point, reasonably happily married Smiths will stay that way.
Do you know, even I meet even really happily married couples where there's debate about how the wealth, the family wealth created between them should be used. You know, one member of the family might say, well, actually, I would love a Swiss chalet, skiing, all the rest of it. They'll say, no, I want to put the kids through school and buy them a house in Brighton to live in as students. Who's going to win? The one with the money in their name. You know, that's the inequality of it, really.
And presumably because if you have children as a woman, you will leave the workforce. So many more people are self-employed or freelance. So those gaps aren't being covered by, you know, your employer paying into a pension scheme or whatever. Actually, over the course of your lifetime, that really adds up, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And, you know, the women seek flexibility often because they're the primary carers. So they're fitting their careers in around so many other demands on their time that are unpaid work. You know, so they're running homes, they're normally as a couple as well, they meet early on in their lives together, the decision about whose career is going to be promoted, you know, and they both get behind promoting the career with the biggest earnings potential for the family. And guess what? The gender pay gap turns up immediately in that decision making because university students leave university and seek jobs and the men get paid more than the women out of the gates.
Yeah, and it's so on First Mother, isn't it? Because actually what precedes that is girls in school doing just as well, if not better, than boys. So it is the real world that is doing this, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's the bad side of it all. What we would really like to do with this interview is empower our listeners, many of whom are women, to feel braver about investing and be pointed in a really good direction about investing. So if you are one of those women who has really identified with everything that we've been talking about there, where would you start with investments?
I think it's important to keep it simple. And women are risk aware. They are not risk averse. That's a myth. But, you know, if you ask, and what does the word risk mean as well? That's a very different thing. If you talk to a chap about what risk means, you generally get a different response to if you ask a woman what risk means. So a lot of it is going to depend on your appetite for risk. But the regulator's got quite a responsibility to take here for changing the meaning of the word risk when it comes to talking about investments. Because actually, if you convert that word in your mind to opportunity, and then you ask yourself, do you want an investment with no opportunity? Then leave it in the bank.
Yeah.
You know, if you want an investment with the opportunity to grow more than inflation.
Grow then, or decrease in value too.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you're talking about the long term, it's really, really shocking how the science of investing is very predictable.
Go on.
It's really hard to lose money in a well-diversified global portfolio over 5 to 10 years.
Okay.
You know? So yeah. The thing is, don't go out and try and choose the stock of the century. Don't try and choose the next NVIDIA, Microsoft, you know, because you'll get it wrong more often than you'll get it right, you know? So just to go with a globally diversified portfolio. And, you know, it works. We know it works. Centuries of investing has rewarded those who lend their money or give their money to companies so as they can make money out of your money. And they wouldn't, people wouldn't still be investing if they didn't get a reward for doing it. Yeah.
And it's so true, isn't it? Because actually in our youth, and I think we're all roughly the same age, the FTSE 100, probably in our 20s, hadn't even topped 3,000, had it? And you look at it now, and that is an unrecognisable figure. Yeah. So when you say globally diverse fund, I mean, unpack that for us. What are we looking for?
Okay, right. So there are basically four asset classes: equity, fixed interest, cash and property. And ideally what you'll do is you'll have a fund with all of those options in it, because that is diversification number one across the asset classes. Now, you might not understand what those asset classes are. You might not be that interested. But the point is they move at different rates at different times and different things affect them. So if you've got a little bit of everything in your portfolio, it's not all likely to be tanking at the same time. Neither is it all likely to be growing at the same time. There's always going to be a dog in there. You have to accept one's going to be behind the others. And the temptation as human beings is for us to go, oh, that's done so very well. Let's put everything on that for next year. And of course, next year's probably not the year that that's going to do really well. If it did well this year, it's probably one of the laggards. So you need to stay diversified and not get tempted with something that's, by the time you hear about it in the news, it's too late to be investing. So stay diversified, stay with a bit of everything going on, keep it across the globe. Economics these days is not a local game, it's a global game. So keep it spread across the globe and stay with the good and strong.
Right.
In the world.
You use the word fund. To a lot of us, I just think, well, how do I get a fund? I don't know what you mean. Is it an off-the-shelf thing
It is. And it's a collective investment. Unless you've already got $500,000 to invest, you need to be doing it collectively, really, for it to be cost-effective for you. If you're going to spread your money over all of these different companies across the globe, you're going to need to do it in a collective investment, a fund, where your money is pooled with other people's money. And that fund that's collected together, that's where the word comes from, is then invested in a great big portfolio of assets, and you participate in that shared portfolio of assets. So, yeah, that's a fund. Multi-asset means it's got more than just one of those four asset classes
in it.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
So you can then spread it out across the asset classes. And the fund manager will do the thing that's really hard for us to do as human beings. It's really hard for us to look at the one that's done really well and go sell it. Sell it at the top. let's buy that thing that's done really badly, that horrible dog in the portfolio. But the fund manager will do that automatically for you. They will sell what's done well and buy what's done poorly to keep the balance between the asset classes in the fund. So it produces this discipline of behaviour that we don't do on our own.
So. Is it easy to find out the people who are good at doing this? So the people who are running those funds as individuals, surely if we look at their pedigree, we will be able to learn something about what they might do with our money.
Okay, yes, yeah, it is. But I'm a bit of a proponent of passive investing. I think if you stick with the science, the numbers, the evidence and the data, and you don't try and predict what's going to happen next, you just sort of track the science of investing over history and stay with that pattern, then, you know, you will get the rewards that investors have got for centuries. So don't look for more than that. Don't look for more than the market return. And you can do it really inexpensively, very diversified, and they're easy to find because it's all data driven. So look at the numbers.
For anyone who thinks, oh, I don't know anything about this world and I'm not involved in it, if you have a pension, then you are involved.
You are an investor.
Yeah, you are, aren't you? Mm.
And you know, the other thing that many people don't realise is that that pension fund is likely to be the biggest asset of your lifetime. Bigger than your home. You know, it's likely to be the thing that is worth the most during your lifetime.
Right. So, and this, so let's say you've worked in the public sector all your life, you've been a teacher or you've been a nurse. You have a pension fund that is invested on your behalf. Mm. So none of us are outside this world, actually,
no,
are we?
No. And if you, I mean, people who have these defined benefit pension schemes that you're describing, teachers and civil servants and the likes, they don't get any agency really over what the investments are in. Whereas many of the modern pensions, you actually get to choose and direct what your investments are in. And I meet lots of people. I represent a company that specialises in advising women, and women are 63% of our investors invest with a socially responsible screen on their investments. So they want to direct their pension money to things that are favourable to the planet and its inhabitants, rather than just going for squeezing every last penny they can get out of the value of the investment.
And it is a truth, isn't it, Samantha, that actually over the last 5 years or so, people have made so much money out of arms. You know, investing in war has been particularly profitable and in fossil fuels. Mm. And many people don't want that. A lot of our listeners have sent emails about exactly this. Katie says, please will you ask where I can invest my inheritance ethically? I don't want to be supporting the arms industry or companies who are environmentally damaging. So what are the words that we need to look out for that would identify those funds has been good for Katie?
There's a whole soup of them, actually. The FCA, so the Financial Conduct Authority, has come up with a standard labelling regime, which funds and opportunities are gradually adopting. But to be honest, they only launched this a couple of years ago, and a lot of the funds were launched, you know, a decade or more ago. So they don't fit into the FCA's new labelling regime. New ones are being designed that do meet the criteria, and it's easier to see. But the FCA call them all sustainable, and it's sustainable either focused, improvers, there's a mixed one, there's an impact one. And the difference between so sustainable improvers might be people who don't yet meet the criteria of being, you know, a fully fledged, everything in there is doing the right thing for the planet and its people, but they're heading that way. And they're on, you know, they're on roadmaps which meet criteria along the way. So those people really need investors' money to make those improvements. So excluding them from an ethical portfolio isn't very helpful. You know, helping them improve is very useful. You can get others where literally the objective of the investment is to impact a certain thing. And if you're very focused, you would do that. Some sustainable funds exclude. So they say, right, we don't do arms, we don't do fossil fuel, and they're more focused on what they don't do. Mm-hmm. And then anything else that's meeting a criteria gets in.
What's the feeling in your waters about what might happen at the budget with Rachel Reeves possibly closing down the amount of money that can go into a cash ISA in order to persuade us to invest specifically as well in UK companies in stocks and shares ISAs? Do you think that that will work? And And if she does that, should we all go with her?
I've got no idea what she's going to do with the mess that is the UK's finances. I think messing around with ISAs or pensions would be a mistake. I think you undermine the trust in your savers and investors and pension builders when you keep messing around with the flipping rules. So I hope she doesn't mess around with them. I don't think it's right for government to try and dictate where and what we should invest in. If the UK isn't an economy strong enough to stand up on a global stage, then why should we be forced to invest in it with our pension money?
It does seem odd, this obsession with, well, we're told you can't have as much money in a cash ISA, so we want you to invest. We want you, a desperate view, to invest in stocks and shares. But to a lot of people, that just seems too risky. And as you say at the moment, quite perilous.
I don't think, if you stick with the long-term vision of investing, if you look at any world stock market graph over 20 years, 75% of the time it's going up. And cash, how often do we actually say there's a massive, massive risk associated with being in cash? People go, no, it's not. Can't go down in value. It buys less every year as it goes backwards against inflation. Well, in my opinion, that's going down in value. It's going down in buying terms. Just because the number on your statement doesn't reduce, the amount you can buy with it is what reduces, doesn't mean it hasn't gone down. So, like, people don't understand.
I wish I'd met you before.
The risk associated with staying in cash.
Yeah, okay. Do you think that the younger generation of women will have a different attitude to investing? So, you know, in 40 years' time, a group of three, as we are, just wouldn't need to have this conversation.
I think the baby boomer generation have enjoyed, you know, a lot of privileges that unfortunately younger generations don't have. When I bought my first house, it was 4.5 times the average wage. It takes 8.5-9 times the average wage now to buy a property. So they're kind of almost forced out of the property market. They stay at home for longer because they can't get on the property market. They're having children later. Everything's kind of moved back 10 years. It's all a bit difficult to compare. But what I will tell you is that I set women's wealth up so that I could get in front of women 20 years earlier. I was meeting them in their 60s and thinking, if I'd known you 20 years ago, life, you'd be so much better off. So it was, how do I get in front of women in their 40s? Because that's when you start to have a bit more disposable income. That's when you start to really worry about the future. All of a sudden it dawns on you.
But can I ask, do you still encounter women who just say, oh, well, my husband deals with that? And let's be honest, we often people in those sorts of relationships, whether it's two women, two men, one will do one thing and the other one will do different
aspects. And you know what's wrong with that? Division of
labour. There isn't, but...
But I don't see why. I suppose because I run a business called Women's Wealth and because I openly attract women to come and talk to me about money, I meet women who are the boss of the finances.
As many are.
And they're attracted to the brand and I talk to them and we... I often find myself protecting the primary carer, which is, in that circumstance, often the male. You know, she's the main earner, he's the primary carer.
Let's say you are, or you have a child who's 23, 24... Really, as a concerned parent, you ought to be telling them, look, just put, if you do inherit $5,000, it's boring. You probably want to go on holiday. Okay, go on a $2,000 holiday, put $3,000 in a pension or some sort of fund.
I think auto-enrolment's been a blessing.
Right.
So those who are employed generally end up put into an auto-enrolment pension fund.
Yeah, because they didn't exist all that long ago. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it?
So it's been, auto-enrolment's been incredibly successful in terms of nudging behaviour in the right direction. And there's no doubt about it, the first pound that you ever invest is the one that earns the most, because it's there.
Compound interest. Compound interest month is so important, isn't it? And actually, we both used to be at the BBC. We try not to mention it too much because it's just triggering for everybody. But obviously, you know, there was a gender pay gap in the corporation reflected in real life as well. And we used a compound interest calculator to try and make the point about that pay gap. And if a man doing the same job at the BBC was paid £200 a month more than the woman, by the end of their career, the man would be £249,000 better off. I mean, it clarifies your thought process, doesn't it? We don't talk about that enough, do we? We really don't use our brain and all the tools that are out there
to go, this is
what it adds
yes,
up to.
It's yeah. a lot. Right, yeah. We've made everybody very angry. Samantha, what do I do? I want to do something. I want to get started. Where do I go?
Okay, you need a multi-asset fund, a collective fund. You do your ISA and your pension in that. If you want it screened for socially responsible investing, there are multi-asset screened funds. You can choose them.
But can we be even more basic? I don't know where to go. Do I Google something? Do I go to an office? What, do I make a phone call? What?
I would say take advice, obviously. I'm a chartered financial planner, and I think that the value in taking investment advice is huge, not only from the fact that you will then know you're in the right thing, and that it's high quality. I'm an independent financial advisor, so I compare the market and I know who's top of the pops, but they don't stay top of the pops.
No.
So you then need somebody who's helping you review it. But there's also the kind of the psychological payback of knowing that you've got a best financial friend rooting for you. You make sure you get your paperwork out every year, even though you don't want to, and dust it off and, you know, just check everything's up to date. So I think there's huge amounts of value in taking advice. I also recognise that there aren't enough advisors to go round.
Enough female advisors?
Well, I'm trying to do something about that, but no, and it's gone backwards, not forwards. So at one time we had 26% female advisors, pathetically low. Now we've got 23. So
that's really bad.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Because I think I would prefer to speak to a woman, just because I would be less embarrassed by my own ignorance, I think. Isn't that terrible?
But you know, it's so not the case, though.
No, okay.
It's not the case. The thing is that when a man shows up to talk to me, bearing in mind that I've only specialised with working with women since 2019. So when men show up, they come with an agenda. They say, let me tell you what you can do for me.
Okay.
When women show up, they go, oh, God, I haven't got a clue. I hope you know what I need to do here. They're much more teachable. They want to learn.
Samantha Seacombe, the founder of Women's Wealth. Times Radio, 3:30 to 4.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly, so must we. £50 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £50, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Oh, hang on. What about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Yes, we are Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Brought to you at the moment by Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk. Our thanks to our big guest this afternoon. That was Samantha Seacombe. Who have we got tomorrow afternoon?
We are talking to the Lady Mayoress of London, Dame Susan Langley. I've already done that interview and she is superb, Jane. So we will look forward to putting it out after 3:30.
Yeah. Yeah. And her significance, she's called it, calling herself the Lady.
Yeah, so
and
she's
that's the first time.
She's the third woman to hold the position, but the first to change the title. It's quite funny to think that the previous incumbents who were female were still lords.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's lovely. Let's find out more about that tomorrow afternoon on Times Radio. Our thanks today to Felix, to Rosie, to Hannah and to everybody else involved in the programme. Notably, of course, the brilliant Ryan Boyden, our technical operator. Have a good, if chilly, evening, and John Pienaar will join you from four.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Former Metropolitan Police Officer David Carrick has been found guilty of more sexual offences. The Defence Secretary says he's got military options drawn up as a Russian spy ship loiters on the edge of UK waters. And coming up, Britain is nowhere near being able to defend itself and its allies from attack. We'll take a closer look with the chair of the Commons Defence Committee. Our political editor, Anna Mikhailova, will be telling us what she's been hearing on the Labour back benches. It sounds uneasy. And the political row growing in Ukraine. And also on the programme, why the Scottish can't stop smiling.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Deputy Chair of the Public Accounts Committee has told Times Radio stark lessons need to be learnt as a report warns the NHS is failing to cut waiting times as promised. The cross-party group likened the government's NHS reforms to the mismanagement of HS2. It's cast serious doubts over whether Labour can fulfil its key pledge to fix the NHS by ensuring patients can get hospital care within 18 weeks by 2029. Clive Betts singled out outpatient services, saying improvements that were meant to come were completely ineffective.
No measurable improvement whatsoever in outpatient waiting time. That is just incredible. One of the reasons was that the clinicians involved in outpatients, and there are a lot of different specialties there, were never on board with this. They never got engaged with it. So if you don't engage with the people providing the service, it's quite likely the service won't get any better. And there's a really stark lesson to be learned from that particular aspect.
Former Metropolitan Police Officer David Carrick has been found guilty of more sexual offences, including against a 12-year-old girl in the late 1980s and raping a former partner. The 50-year-old's already serving a life sentence after admitting other sex attacks against 12 women over 17 years. A Russian spy ship is currently on the edge of UK waters, but the government insists military options are ready if it turns towards the coastline. A man accused of trying to kill someone in East London is being freed from prison despite concerns he could re-offend. A senior lawyer has called it a disaster waiting to happen. Tom Crosdale reports.
36-year-old Tom Maughan's been charged with attempted murder following an attack in Dalston earlier this year. He's due to go on trial in June 2026, 7 months after the case was sent to Crown Court. But the law says trials have to start within 6 months. A judge has said there's no room to have it sooner, so has been left with no choice but to release Maughan on bail.
The government's previously promised to tackle the court backlog, saying it inherited a justice system in crisis. Inflation's eased for the first time since March, giving a boost to the government ahead of the budget next week. Official figures show it slowed to 3.6% last month after 3 months at 3.8%. The Chancellor's been told to tax people with unfair advantages, meanwhile, before targeting those from working households. Progressive think tank the IPPR says Rachel Reeves needs to pick up the right fights in next week. Budget. And the Home Secretary has told a summit of police and crime commissioners that their roles have been a failed experiment.
I believe the position of a police and crime commissioner, unfortunately, has not worked. Without necessary investment in creating a public profile, too many voters were unaware of the existence of the position or its occupant.
Shabana Mahmood explained she's scrapping the positions because they've created division among forces in England and Wales when there should be more cooperation. She says the only way to avoid a postcode lottery of law enforcement is to streamline some services. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with IG.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive On Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. A Russian spy ship offshore north of Scotland sounds a bit alarming, but actually it's quite normal, or at least uncomfortably familiar. What is truly alarming is today's parliamentary report that the UK is nowhere near, and that is an actual quote from the Defence Committee, nowhere near being able to defend itself and its allies from attack. And most worrying is the fact that warnings that the country is in no shape to defend itself from an attack are becoming familiar, even normal. Today, the Defence Secretary, John Healey, used a Downing Street news conference to reassure people, or try to, that he'd deliver what he called a new era of defence. He also rejected a warning from the Defence Committee. NATO had to be ready for the United States to reduce its commitment to NATO. The government takes a different view, said the Defence Secretary. And now the Times reports that America's ambassador to NATO has floated the possibility of handing overall command of NATO to a German commander when the European allies are ready to operate more independently of US military dominance. So surely, if we're not worried about our comparative weakness, our sheer inability to face foreign aggression, which means Russia and its allies, if it means anything, well, maybe we should be. Because a senior cross-party committee of MPs clearly is worried. And you can hear my conversation with its Labour chair, Tan Dissey, in a moment. I wonder what you are thinking. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. And later on, the sheer joy among Scots, and not just football fans, at last night's last gasp victory in the World Cup qualifier, which takes Scotland into the finals in the USA next year, had to be seen to be believed. And if you're one of those who don't get the power of football to bring light to millions of lives, well, keep listening. Firstly, these warnings of British unpreparedness, they come on the back of signals that America is seeking a greater withdrawal from its traditional role in Europe. The American ambassador to NATO made some concerning suggestions at a defence conference in Berlin. The Times' Oliver Moody is there, and he sent this report.
There has been a controversy as Matthew Whitaker, the United States ambassador to NATO, said that the United States would like to see Germany or another large European military take command of Allied forces in Europe. This is a big deal because since 1951, when Dwight Eisenhower became the first American general to become the supreme Allied commander in Europe, that role has always been held by a four-star American general.
And here's Oliver Moody on how those comments went down.
Sitting next to Matthew Whitaker at this conference was Lieutenant General Wolfgang Wien, who is Germany's representative on the NATO Military Committee and one of the most senior generals in the German armed forces. And he openly expressed his astonishment. On the whole, though, Whitaker was very much there to spread a message of reassurance. He piled praise on Germany for brokering the new NATO spending target for 3.5% of GDP on the armed forces and 1.5% on broader security issues. And he called on the other allies to step up and be more like Germany, which is going to hit those targets, or at least plans to, by 2029.
Oliver Moody reporting there. Well, just ahead of the show, I spoke to Tan Dissey, the Labour MP, who is the chair of Parliament's Defence Committee, and discussed the report his MPs had just produced.
The House of Commons Defence Committee has undertaken a comprehensive look into UK's contribution to European security. And for the last year, we've had various evidence sessions, lots of experts inputting in their feelings on the issue. We've had several visits, and that's why the findings for us didn't make for good reading, in the sense that we just wanted to make sure that we are sounding the alarm over the UK's ability to be able to defend our homeland. And we felt that there was